Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Richard Brennan from Rathfarnham in Dublin was ordained as a priest in 1989 and moved to the US, but he later left the priesthood. He married, had a family, and continued to work and volunteer with local churches there. Earlier this month, he admitted 24 sample offences, including the rape of his sisters Paula and Catherine when they were children and the indecent assault of another sister, Yvonne. The 64-year-old man has been jailed for 8 years. An older brother, Bernard, was jailed in June for 4.5 years for sexual abuse in their home. Paula Fay and Catherine Wrightstone have survived to tell their story. It is a distressing one, but they really want people to hear them today. And they're both in studio. Good morning to you, Paula and Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And Paula, can I ask with you, and do you mind if I ask you to kind of tell us about your home life growing up in Rathfarnham? There were 7 siblings in the family, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. There were 7 children, ranging Bernard being the eldest, mm-hmm. to our youngest sister, Sinead. There was possibly around a 15 to 17 year age gap between the children.
Yeah, and your mother, Catherine Marie, she suffered mental health issues really all her life.
She did. Yeah, from the time that I was quite young, I remember her being in and out of hospital, struggling with significant depression.
Forever, for all your childhood.
Yes.
And your dad, did he cope, or he had issues of his own?
He did. Dad was what we would refer to as a functioning alcoholic.
Right.
So he was able to hold down a good job and run a business. But more than a few times a year, he would go on drinking binges. They would travel and he would drink for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
Very bad.
Very bad.
But to outside eyes, it was a family with a nice home, a holiday house, I think, as well, and trips abroad.
Correct. Yeah.
Things looked very, very good from the outside. Do you remember your childhood, Paula, before the abuse began?
I have some memories of my childhood before the abuse began, which was, you know, quite pleasant, I would have to say. Obviously, I was very much aware that there were issues regarding my mother and father in the family home, and which at times led to physical abuse. My father at times could be quite physically abusive to our mother. And unfortunately, then in turn, our mother would be actually quite physically abusive to us as children.
Right.
In turn.
Childhood was very short.
Yes, absolutely. And there was a lot of responsibility put on older siblings, mm-hmm. to take care of younger siblings. So from the time I turned 7, 8, the responsibility of Catherine kind of fell on my shoulders. And
really?
Then in turn, when Sinead was born, I would have taken a lot of the responsibility of rearing Sinead as well.
And you were a child.
And I was actually a child, yeah.
You've been very protective, obviously.
I was very protective of them. I absolutely adored my 2 younger sisters. And I loved them with all my heart, you know.
Paula, unfortunately, the abuse, it begins with Bernard. What was the age gap between the two of you?
So at the time, I was 7 years old and Bernard would have been approximately 13 from my memory. Mm-hmm. He was like a teenager and I just felt like he was an adult. Do you know, at that time, I just felt like he was a grown up.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of authority in the family home. It was like he was like as if he was a parent to us. I was very fearful of him. And he also could be quite physically violent. So you just kind of more or less did whatever you were asked or whatever you were told. That's kind of where it kind of stemmed from. The parents, my parents may not have been around all of the time when abuse was occurring, but they were there on occasions as well where it was happening late at night, after people had gone to bed and were asleep. That's when a lot of the abuse was occurring for me.
And you endured years of it at Bernard's hands.
Bernard got married at quite a young age and moved out of the family home. He was only probably about 18, I think,
right,
when he got married. And then that's when it stopped. I was approximately 12 at that point in my life when it stopped. And I thought that that was going to be it, that it wasn't going to continue. But that was not the case, unfortunately. It continued with just Richard after that point in time until I was about 17 and a half years old.
Extraordinary long time.
Yeah. And at times during the period that Bernard was living at home, it was what you would regard as simultaneous. So I was being abused by both brothers at the same time. So it was very, very difficult environment to be in.
We thought we've been shocked by stories before, but that is standalone shocking.
Yeah.
This is the 1970s we're talking about.
That is correct.
Richard is training to be a priest at the time. He knows what he's doing is wrong. In fact, you even tell him as well.
I said it on many an occasion while he was actually abusing me that this was wrong and that he should be seeking help, that he needed help. And he would say things to me like, oh, there's no need to worry about that. Sure, I'm going to be a priest, a man of God, and he will save me.
He had an especially vindictive threat as well, didn't he, about what might happen?
Yeah, well, he had learned.
If you told anyone.
Yeah, well, he had kind of technically learned that threat from his older brother, Bernard, because from very early on, the threat was that if I spoke up, I would break the family up, that our mother would end up in a lunatic asylum, and that our father would probably drink himself to death, and that we'd all end up split up in different orphanages and I'd never see my siblings again. So that was a real valid threat, because I can recall on one occasion not being in the family home where we were technically in care. It's very, very vague. I was quite young at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was actually real. That threat was very, very real.
Yeah. That's exactly what would have happened.
Yeah, and I didn't want to be obviously split up, particularly from my younger brother, Eamon, and my sister, Yvonne, and my two younger sisters, Catherine and Sinead, when they came along.
And you mentioned that protection you had over them. Catherine, you were 10 years younger than Richard. But sadly, unbeknownst to your older sister, Paula here, he began abusing you.
He did, yeah. It was June of 1980. I was 9 years of age. He was 19. He was convicted, in my case, he pled guilty to 13 sample charges of indecent assault and 2 counts of rape. And the abuse was age 9 through 14. So it was 1980 to 1985. It was December of 1985. I had no idea. I thought it was me. I thought I was the only one. I thought mm-hmm. there was something fundamentally wrong with me.
Blamed yourself.
Yeah, I did. I did. And that's actually quite common. You tend to internalize guilt and shame, incredible amounts of shame. It was just so disorienting that this person that lives in your home, that you trust, an older brother, would do something like this. So it was disgusting. It made no sense. It was horrible.
The attacks changed you totally, obviously, because you're a child. This clearly would have been noticed by your parents.
I believe it would have been. I know that I had wet the bed on a couple of occasions, which is a quite common indicator that there is a problem. I do remember struggling with a few health issues, which is also quite common. Mm. But then finally, I was 12 years of age when I told my best friend, Michelle Goggins, and she's been fantastic. She encouraged me to go tell an adult. We saw this person as an authority mm-hmm. that could do something. And Michelle encouraged me, you know, it'll be OK. It'll stop. The person that I told at the school told that nun contacted my parents. All hell broke loose at home that night. Everything that I feared would happen happened. And my parents did nothing for months. And then I was in a hospital. I was having lower leg limb paralysis. And it was a psychiatrist in that particular hospital that had spoken with me. And this was months after I had disclosed the abuse initially. And then I disclosed to her what was happening. And she was the one that made the referral to St. John of God's.
This is essentially a second telling of your story.
Correct. And then it stopped. I had a bit of a reprieve for a little while. And I thought, oh, good, we're done. And it continued. It continued late into that year of 1985.
It's extraordinary, first of all, that you and your friend, Michelle, you were 12 years of age. And this is 1983, 1984. And like the bravery of telling an adult that.
Thank you. I can't really describe it. I think I felt this strong internal drive to, I guess, protect. I was very worried about Sinead. I kept thinking, like, in my brain at that time, okay, she was a similar age to what I was when it started. So I decided I would say something. But I was afraid because things were escalating and things were so bad. And we were talking about rape, which is like surviving a homicide where sex is used as the weapon. And it is just the most horrific act that anybody. It's a total and complete violation of one's body, dignity, your bodily autonomy, integrity. But it is a little part of you dies. That's the only way I can describe it. It is just a devastating violation.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt as the abuse was escalating in my case. And again, there were four counts of rape when it came to the charges against Richard with myself. And as that was escalating, I just felt dead inside. That's exactly how I would describe it.
When the nun rings your parents to tell them what they've heard, what does your mum say to you?
Oh, she was irate. I don't know if I can use the language on air, but she called me a liar and she called me a dirty bitch.
That's devastating.
Absolutely. Yeah. She was very angry. She was angry because she viewed it as I had ruined his reputation. And, you know, it was something along the lines of these things sort of happen in families and, you know, we just have to sort of get on with it. But then in the next breath, I was a liar and I was a dirty bitch.
Yeah. How do you feel about that now? She clearly wasn't well.
That's it exactly. And I know this is going to sound really weird because my parents obviously were quite neglectful and quite abusive, but I loved my parents and I see them as complicated beings who endured their own trauma, who never got any help for their own trauma. My mother was struggling with depression and psychosis at times. So I think that she was overwhelmed. She had no support, inadequate treatment. But she did behave very, very badly. So when you hear that, when your mother is calling you that, again, it adds to that internalization of shame and guilt and there must be something wrong with me.
Now, you obviously have some kind of towering strength inside you because that's the first telling when
Correct.
You go to adults again and the psychiatric assessment of John of God's. But they do something incredible. There's a family therapy meeting set up in the second telling. Do you remember this, Paula?
Yes, I actually do remember it. Now, obviously, I wasn't exactly aware at the level of the abuse that had been occurring for Catherine. I got informed by my mother that we had to go to this family therapy session. But because of how my mother had reacted, I found it extremely difficult to voice that it also had happened to me. And that became even more apparent while we were attending the family therapy sessions.
But just to describe how insane this session is, the abuser is present. Mm.
That is correct. Yeah.
Sitting across from
me. Yeah.
In the room.
All of us all together in that room, all at the same time. And it's extremely difficult in that sort of an environment to have the strength or courage to say anything.
And with all of these grown-ups and authorities who know what's happening in the home, the result is effectively nothing.
It was handled extremely, extremely poorly. And then, like as I said, I finished there and I thought, OK, great, that's done. And then there were two more incidents of indecent assault that I could remember. And what's interesting about this is that, and I'm sure Paula can relate to this, the acts were so frequent when he was home from the seminary that I could not provide an exact number of incidents to the guards. Mm-hmm. So when, and I'm glad you used that word earlier, that he pled guilty to sample charges. So the 15 against me are only a very small number of what actually occurred.
Sample of what you can clearly identify.
What we could clearly identify and differentiate as being different incidents.
Because in order to get it through the court system, there has to be quite good memory of specific incidences.
And detail.
And quite detailed, yes.
It's extraordinary to us after everything you did. You told an educator, professionals, and incredibly you're let down, you're a child in danger. Nobody even contacts the Gardaí.
No.
And the sense of isolation that you feel is like emotional and physical isolation. Like I felt somewhat set apart in a way, which was, when I think about that little girl, it makes me really sad. But it just was what it was. But it's that in a way is also a betrayal. Mm-hmm. When you know, my parents didn't handle it correctly. It was deep, deep betrayal.
Eventually, Richard Brennan, he leaves the home. He's obviously still a free man. Catherine, when do you start writing letters to America?
Yeah, so I started, and I don't know exactly the year, but it would have been 98. I wrote a letter to his wife. And
this is because you had only just discovered.
I had discovered that they were married and that she had had a child.
You didn't know this information.
No.
Was sprung on you. Does that mean that the family dynamic has kind of broken up?
To a certain extent, yeah. There was very little contact between us and these particular brothers, and most specifically Richard. There was very little contact.
What about the parents, your parents' relationship with Richard?
They had a very good relationship with Richard, and, you know, everything was idolised around Richard. I know that at the time that he chose to leave the priesthood, my mother having a very, you know, bad reaction to that. She wasn't too happy about him actually leaving the priesthood.
That's the only thing he did wrong in her eyes.
Yeah, that was exactly. That's exactly how it was viewed.
So some of the family are in America. Are you there as well, Catherine?
I am in America, yeah.
You become a social worker, so you're very aware of child protection issues.
Very much so, yeah.
So I presume nothing happens in the 90s letters that you send. You're alerting his new family.
So in 2012, we wrote a letter to the minister there, informing him of
this
all...
This is of the church that Richard is involved in.
The church that Richard... Yeah, I found out that he was... because my mother had said to me he wouldn't have access to children and everything was okay. And then I found out that that was actually not true. And I discovered that he was very heavily involved with youth programs, going on skiing trips and other things like
pool
that.
Pool parties.
Yeah.
Things
and
like
he
that.
Was the director of religious education for a youth program there. So I wrote to this minister and outlined the abuse that we had suffered. And
we all signed the letter. The girls had signed the letter, you know, in support of this, that, you know, it wasn't just one sister here we're talking about.
It's other, pretty emphatic, this letter.
Exactly.
Yes.
What sort of response do you get?
I got a phone call from an attorney, and he asked me to retract the statement because, quote, Richard had brought a lot of money into the church and he had grown the youth program exponentially, and he was a gifted individual, Richard. So you know, surely I didn't want Richard to end up in jail, I think it was at the time.
This is 2012.
This was in 2012.
You hadn't gone to the Gardaí at this point.
No.
What's holding you back at this stage in your lives? And by the way, you've only learned in the last 10 years before that, haven't you? 10, 20 years of each other's abuse.
That is correct. I divulged my abuse to Catherine in around 1992. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, Catherine had ended up in needing some mental health treatment.
Of course.
And when she came out, I actually told her about my abuse. But at that time, I was in no position to kind of really even talk about it. I felt it was too painful for me. I was worried about how it would actually impact me, my own mental health. And I asked her not to say anything. And in fairness to Catherine, she didn't. And I think it was, I'm not quite sure when Yvonne had divulged what had happened to her.
2015 for me.
As late as that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very conscious of Yvonne's not here. She's in America.
Yes.
She's a very important voice in
she
this.
Does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yvonne had actually a very affluent career here prior to actually going to America. She would have been quite well known in the music circuit. She was a professional singer and participated a lot in, you know, the concert hall. She was a coricatura soprano. So she was involved a lot in musical theatre and performing in different venues throughout the country. So
that's how she survived.
I think that's clearly how she survived. Yes. Yeah.
Your parents, they seem to know everything that had gone on in their home to their children at the hands of the two older boys. Do they ever discuss this with you before the end of their lives? Do they ever express sorrow for what you endured?
For me, we were ignored for a while once they really understood what had happened. I do recall getting a phone call from my father a couple of weeks after the letter in 2012 to kind of more or less apologise to me for what had happened. And he asked me categorically to, so in your case, Paula, it wasn't just Richard, it was also Bernard. And I said, yes, that is correct. And he was very apologetic that the right thing hadn't been done. But with regard to my mother, she never actually spoke to me about it again, ever. She refused to talk to me for a very long time. And then when she did talk to me, it was about anything other than the abuse that had occurred. So I never got an apology from my mother at all.
The denial was so powerful.
Denial was so powerful, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. The one thing that she did say when we were caring for our parents, we cared for both of our parents when they passed, but our mum had asked me if she could talk to Richard before she died. And I said, okay, mum. So she had myself and Sinead dial the number. And she told Richard, this was just two or three days before she died. She told Richard on the phone, your sisters forgive you. So that was, but like Paula, my father actually had called me in 2012 after it became, you know, after they became aware that it wasn't just me, that it was also my siblings. My father called me, apologized, cried on the phone, said a lot of things that were, I found, very helpful to me. It was quite a cathartic conversation. But mum chose to not discuss it, like Paula, wouldn't talk to me for months, ignored my phone calls, and then finally had a chat, but avoided that conversation. And then when she was dying in 2014,
she makes that call.
That's when she asked to speak to Richard. I put the phone up to her, because she hadn't a lot of energy at that point. She was dying, actively dying.
Are you both there?
I was not there.
No, it was myself and Sinead were in the room.
What is your reaction to that? Because
it was devastating. It was devastating. Obviously, my mother is dying. I'm not going to chastise her. I took the phone from her, got her squared away. I had just bathed her, and I went into the bathroom and I had a cry. So that was quite painful.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. But while they were alive, you just couldn't bring yourself to go to the guards.
No, we really couldn't. I don't know. They had
a hold,
such a hold on us, that it was extremely difficult to move forward with it.
When you grow up in an environment like that, the type of environment that we've described, mm-hmm. what happens is you put your own needs secondary and your parents' needs become primary. Yeah. And we were conditioned to always look out for them. And the worry was, well, if we do this, it's going to kill them. Something bad is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And they're never going to be able to forgive us. So there is this fear. But once they passed, it was easier. And then our beloved Eamon, our brother Eamon, who was a beautiful, beautiful gay man who was just the kindest, gentlest soul you could ever meet. He took his life in 2015. And that's when we all sort of came together.
Both of your parents had just died.
Yes.
Eamon died a year later to suicide. And that was the deciding factor for all of us.
Yeah.
That we needed to actually do something about this because it was just tearing the family apart. And in 2015, we actually did make that decision that we were going to actually move forward and speak up and try and do what we could to get justice for what had happened in our family.
And that poor man, we'll never know what he endured because he didn't get his chance to talk to the Gardaí. He didn't get the chance to talk to you about
that. That is true. I had witnessed as a child him being abused. I could only remember one occasion where both of us were being abused by both of those brothers. And it was just pure and utter devastation. The two of us were extremely upset in the room about what was happening. And unfortunately, we never spoke about it again. It was like it was just way too painful to discuss. And so we never actually discussed it with each other at any point in our adult life or anything. So, yeah, very, very difficult.
Somehow you get yourselves picked up off the floor from this.
We do.
Another blow. And in 2019, you tell the guards everything.
Yeah. And it took that long because I was in charge of three estates, my parents' and my brother's estates. And I didn't close everything up until 2018.
Yeah.
And then I needed to breathe. And then we went to the Gardaí in January of 2019.
Yeah.
Wow. What a moment that was.
Yeah.
Yes. This is your power returning to you, really, isn't it?
Correct.
Absolutely.
It does take 3 years, but you'll never forget the phone call you get in late 2022, is it, Paula?
That's from my memory, yes. Receiving a call through the Gardaí that were investigating the case to inform us that finally the DPP had made a decision regarding our case and that they were actually going to move forward with it. And it was just like monumental. It was like, wow. We're actually going to get this into court.
They're going to be charged and prosecuted.
Yeah.
Both men, both brothers who were in America at this time.
They were both in America at that time, yes. Yeah.
And they face a threat of extradition, so they just come home.
Correct. Yes, that's correct.
A long, long ordeal. March of this year. How long had it been since you'd seen either of these men?
I believe the last time that I saw Richard was at our mother's funeral because she insisted that he attend. And the last time that I saw Bernard was at Eamon's funeral.
Yeah. What was that moment like seeing him, either of them in court?
It was kind of surreal. It was kind of, oh my God, it was very nerve wracking.
Were you worried that he, might get away from the charges or what was your...
There was that concern, yes. There was that concern.
But it was re-traumatising, essentially.
Very much, yes.
Bernard pleads guilty, but Richard pleaded not guilty. How did you both feel about that?
We had probably discussed it prior to us ever going to court and we kind of knew that that was the way he would approach it, that he would actually plead not guilty to any of the charges.
This meant a trial and it meant you'd have to get into the witness stand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you do have to do that, don't you, both of you?
Yes.
Yeah. We all three of us, actually, Yvonne gave evidence via a video link from the USA. And then she was cross-examined. And then I went into the stand. I spent a full day giving evidence, bringing up all of the specific incidences that I could recall. And then one full day being cross-examined. And then it was Catherine then who
got into the stand and she gave her evidence.
Had to do the same thing.
Yes.
And once all three sisters, you've given your evidence, what happens?
Yeah, I was the last one. It was a Thursday. I arrived back at the courthouse that Friday, right before the St. Patrick's Day weekend. I was waiting up in the victim support room to be brought down, to be cross-examined. And then that's when the legal team from the DPP walked in and the two detective sergeants to tell me that Richard had decided to change his plea from not guilty to guilty.
Only after you've already gone through
correct
the horror of having
the horror
to give
correct
the testimony.
Correct.
How did you feel in that moment? Was there any relief at all that he was finally
pleading guilty? I cried for a few minutes in that room. I kept apologising to everybody. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that he had finally acknowledged the truth of what had happened. So there was relief. But I cried. And then later that day, I got to go into the courtroom. The jury was there. They explained to the jury what had happened. The jury was dismissed. And I heard him plead guilty to three sample charges, the most heinous crimes that he had committed against Paula, myself and Yvonne. And then on the 18th of March, he was back in court. And that's when he was taken into custody. And that's when he pled guilty to all of the charges.
All of the charges.
And then this is when we get into sentencing and victim impact statements.
Yeah.
And because Yvonne isn't here, she's in America. I want to read a what she says in her victim impact statement, just a little piece of it. Incest lasts a lifetime. I cannot stress enough how much it has played in my psyche. While I was being cross-examined in court, I was re-traumatised again with new evidence and I am still in shock. If he had pleaded guilty beforehand, she wouldn't have had to go through none of you.
Correct.
Yeah. And I can actually vouch for the fact that that has actually been re-traumatising for her on numerous occasions while I have spoken to her since. So yeah, it really has impacted her even now.
Yeah. Just to let people know, Bernard Brennan, who's now 67, he was jailed for 4.5 years after admitting 11 counts of indecent assault of Paula and Yvonne. And Richard Brennan, who's 64, jailed for 9 years, but the final year is suspended for 24, and they are sample offences. What was your feeling on these sentences?
Deeply disappointed with the leniency of the sentence and the mitigation that was provided.
Yeah.
The mitigating factors were?
Deep remorse.
He had written a letter of apology to us for what had happened. And according to the judge, he was deeply remorseful for what he had done.
And in fairness, you'll understand the point of law here is that the judges hands are tied because the sentencing
yes
guidelines are very strict and they operate along the law. And
yes,
the judge has to take into account a guilty plea, even if it comes late.
Correct.
And similarly, letters of remorse have to be factored in.
Correct. Yeah.
And you understand that and you felt the judge was very sympathetic and empathetic.
I felt that he was extremely kind and compassionate
yeah
when we were on the stand giving evidence.
Yeah.
He was very respectful. Gave us breaks when we needed to, and
yeah,
I am very grateful to Judge Keane for that.
Yeah, he was very much a gentleman throughout
yes
the entire process. Yeah.
Yvonne's words are very, very strong in reaction to the sentence. She says, "Richard is a liar and a very selfish man, a self-serving narcissist. I feel my sisters deserve more years for their pain and suffering. They didn't get complete justice." So you're asking the DPP to appeal Richard's sentence, but not Bernard's?
That is correct, yes. Because when it came to Bernard, he was applying a law dating back to the from 1935 is my understanding, and there was no change in that law until halfway through 1981. And the maximum sentence for sexual assault at that time was 2 years, nothing higher than that, where that changed in 1981. So therefore, he was applying the law at that time. And in fairness to Justice McDermott, he actually gave a consecutive sentence to Bernard.
Catherine, you want changes to the law, don't you?
I absolutely do. I think Irish courts seem to have broad discretion over such cases as ours and lenient sentences, especially in historical sexual abuse cases are sometimes justified on the basis of remorse, time elapsed, And one of the things that I find a little bit disturbing is the offender's recent good character, as stated in character references provided by family and friends who only know what that person allows them to know. So in terms of reform, I would love to see an introduction of mandatory binding sentencing guidelines that treat sexual abuse and rape as serious offences, regardless of the time elapsed, and create a statutory offence under sexual assault for sibling sexual abuse.
That would require legislative change as well, wouldn't it?
It would. In addition, I think that they need to disallow mitigation based solely on family support and the lack of other convictions, because these predatory urges don't just magically disappear, especially when there is no intervention and when decades of denial of abuse by the perpetrator are present, which was the case with Richard. I mean, it was denial right up until the very end. But I would also love to see them issue judicial training directives and case law clarification via statute that family support must not be considered a mitigating factor unless requested by the survivor. And I think they also need to clarify in legislation that delayed disclosure due to trauma and family pressure are not grounds for leniency, because the seriousness of the offences, it doesn't diminish with time. So the law should reflect the continuing harm. And just a few more real quick. Greater inclusion of survivor voices in shaping policy and legal reform. Mandatory consecutive sentences for multiple victims. And last but not least, mandatory trauma-informed training for judges regarding the unique complexity of sibling sexual abuse. I do want to say, if I may, that I'm most grateful to Lavinia Kerwig. She was the first woman in Ireland to waive anonymity.
That's right.
Yeah. I think she's incredible, and she's made significant changes. Mm-hmm. And also to the former Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, who commissioned the O'Malley report. And because of those changes implemented in law, we were able to avail of the victim support room at court, the victim accompaniment to court. It also allowed our sister to give evidence via video link from the US.
This is new, yeah.
This is all new. And this came in 2020. So it's only been 5 years. And also training for the Gardaí. Yeah. I think that was huge.
Paula, you have some ideas of reform, which I think will shine a light on an area of being a survivor and being a witness of these trials.
That's correct.
Wouldn't be common knowledge.
Yeah, well, what I found out is when I informed my employer that I was going to be a witness in a trial, and we had been informed that the trial would take approximately 3 weeks, when I sought leave from my job, I was informed that all I was entitled to was to either take annual leave or unpaid leave, that there was nothing in law to protect me as a witness.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
You can get the day you're giving testimony, but obviously in a trial like this, you want to be present for all of it.
Well, yes, I'm completely committed. I was completely committed to this process from the very beginning, and I feel that we need to be treated differently. I know that jury members are entitled to be paid through their employment when they're on a jury.
They get the time off work for the entire trial,
For the entire trial, exactly. And I feel that something needs to change in that a witness is also doing their civic duty. I feel it should be exactly the same.
As you mentioned, Lavinia Kerwig, and all of the incredible changes that have occurred for victims, and you're campaigning for the next set of victims to come forward.
To come forward.
Given a lifetime. Your strength and the fact that you're here able to talk about this is extraordinary. How is life for you now, for both of you, Paula?
Well, it's a bit chaotic. You know, obviously, we didn't realise at the time that we had made this decision to waive anonymity that it would draw so much public attention. And obviously, we're extremely grateful for that. Yeah. That was our goal, is, you know, to try and bring other people who, you know, have suffered like ourselves, that they will come forward and
never too late.
And it's never, ever too late. Exactly. You know,
you have three grown up kids at home.
I do. Yes, I have three grown-up adults living in my family home still, and they're absolutely amazing. They've been fantastic.
Big yeah. support.
A huge, huge support, yeah. They've been completely and utterly behind me, telling me how important it is to speak out, and also to my partner, Jerry, who has been a complete and utter rock throughout this entire process.
How lovely that you've finally found a lovely family home.
Yes,
I
got married in 1989, and I had my children in 92, 93 and 99. And it's just been, I've been completely committed to them.
That's how you're here.
That's how, exactly.
And Catherine, you've a big anniversary coming up, I believe, a happy occasion.
I do, yeah, 30 years. 30 years married in August. I know, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Married to Todd.
That's correct, yeah.
He's an American, I'm presuming.
He is, yeah, he is, yeah.
But you've left America.
Yeah, we did. I lived there for 30 years, a little over 30 years, and we've been living in Portugal the last couple of years.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's lovely.
You've what we call a blended family.
We do, yeah. We had, so there's four boys in total.
My God.
Yeah, four boys in total. They range in age from, well, my youngest is 24, although he's almost 25, as he keeps reminding me. and the eldest is 39. So, yeah. And
a good broad range of life.
One grandbaby now as well.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
And are those kids, are they in America now, or are they moving over?
So my one son lives in Berlin. My one son, Ray, yeah. He'll be 29 next month, so he's 28. Eamon lives in America. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. And then the other two lads, Terrell and Brandon, one lives in Virginia and one lives in Pennsylvania.
Well, the message is that life, it can be good when you survive.
It can. Yeah.
Despite everything.
There is life after trauma. And I think the key is that you surround yourself with loving others. Yeah. You do the work. It is work, but it can be done. And you just have to engage in self-care.
I also think that it's very important for survivors or victims of abuse engage with counselling, because that has been really, really helpful as well. So I would encourage that for people to actually engage with someone who has knowledge and can get you through that process. Yeah.
And sisters help too.
Well, sisters definitely help.
You're the best of pals,
but I think we are. No, I think like Paula, just to speak to what Paula's saying, like a trauma informed therapist is really really important.
Yeah.
To kind of help you reprocess the trauma of what happened. But
I believe it is doable.
Yes. It is doable.
And so I think that we are trying to give voice for those that can't come forward. We understand that it's a really challenging thing to do. We want to provide hope, you know, that there is our legal system will help, and that the Gardaí will help, and that hopefully other changes will happen. But we do recognise that there have been some that have lost their life under the weight of trauma.
Absolutely.
So we're here to give voice to those, and we thank all of those brave women that came before us.
You're doing an incredible job. We've heard you. Thank you both for talking to us today.
Thank you.
And to illustrate how important it is, of course, to you, Catherine, thank you for flying in from Portugal, especially to make the appeals that you've made today. But we wish you both, and Yvonne as well,
and
your family as well. But Paula Fay and Catherine Wrightstone, take care of yourselves. To those affected listening, supports are available on rte.ie/helplines.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now, we have a statement from the Department of Justice in response to some of Paula and Catherine's calls for reforms that you heard there. In particular, their idea that victims of abuse be entitled to the same amount of time off work for trials as jurors. And here's what it says. The department acknowledges the immense courage it takes for survivors of sexual violence to report abuse and take part in the criminal justice process. There is an important distinction between jury service and being a witness in a criminal trial. Jury duty is a mandatory civic obligation, while witnesses, including survivors of sexual offences, are required to attend court only for the time needed to give their evidence. Supports such as access to court appointment and counselling are available. We are committed to ongoing reform aimed at reducing the re-traumatisation of victims and ensuring every step of the legal process reflects a victim-centred and trauma-aware approach. So they appear to be suggesting that there won't be a change on lengthening the time off for witnesses there. And as you heard Paula Fay and Catherine Wrightstone saying, they believe that, that victims coming forward and giving their testimonies as witnesses is also a real civic duty that they do. In regards to Catherine's call to make sibling sexual abuse a separate and particular crime, the Department of Justice says there are no plans for mandatory sentences for sibling sexual abuse, but all legislation is kept under review. So that's what the department says. Now we go to listeners' messages, and there are many of them. What utterly brave, articulate, strong, empathetic women. They are a credit to this country and to all survivors. Thank you to them for sharing their story. Someone says, wow, these women are extremely brave for sharing their stories. Thank you to them, as no doubt they will help others who have been abused to come forward. And then this next person says, crying in the car while listening to these strong, brave women. My mother and her sister were abused by her brother. She became an alcoholic. Her marriage broke down and it ruined her life and her relationship with us. Abuse destroys so much. I wish all these women all the love in the world. God, the things that people are carrying around with them all the time. Fionnuala is messaging us here. She says, I remember Yvonne Brennan in the 1970s. This is the third sister who wasn't with us in studio. She's in America. She's a beautiful, kind girl and a very talented singer. I'm so angry that she and her sisters had to endure the torment they went through and no one helped them. It's devastating. Another message, Elizabeth and Kerry. Congratulations to those brave women. They shouldn't have to come on national radio to get changes. And I call on our lawmakers and the Director of Public Prosecutions for immediate reform. But of course, it's the lawmakers who do the reform and the DPP is charged with implementing it. Carmel says, I'm blown away with the compassion, articulation and brilliance of those women. What a brilliant insight that you blame yourself and you put your parents before your own pain. I will never forget that interview. Just so powerful. Another one, this is from Orla. She says, I'm so sorry for what each of these powerful sisters have had to go through and I'm so sorry for the loss of their beautiful brother. Your strength in telling your story will bring strength and bravery to others. I hope you all find peace for the future and I'm sending love. And actually was chatting to Paul and Catherine afterwards, Eamon Brennan, their younger brother who died 10 years ago. He was only 50 years of age. Imagine, he just couldn't take that lingering hurt anymore and the illness of depression from the pain took him, basically. It was 10 years ago. And perhaps the most upsetting part of the conversation, despite all of what they've gone through, their thoughts were for their young brother rather than for themselves. And I also want to say as well, the youngest of the seven siblings was Sinead. She suffered some health issues over many years and she died in 2021. She was the fourth in the family to die in 8 years. And she posted a poem she wrote on her social media page and she called it simply, The Bogeyman, and it has the imagery of a monster who arrives in the night. Just devastating. The messages go on. Anne says, this interview is powerful and dignified. The women are incredibly articulate and courageous. I have so much respect for them all. And Anne is in Greystones. Paying staff in a small business for staff to be off while doing jury service is very expensive for the small employer. It's the same as bank holidays. That's a message on some other on the other issues that we mentioned in terms of reform. That's from Mick. To mind your mother shows the real depths of your compassion. You are brave beyond words. And that's from F. And that is an incredible moment where she's looking after her mother. She's dying. And that fiction that she tells the abuser that the girls had forgiven her. It's just extraordinary. We will keep your messages and we'll get back to them another day on 51551 is the text. And Oliver at rte.ie is the email, which will be open for the rest of the day. But